Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
It's gonna want to turn the antenna, but that should be no big deal.
We're gonna put the top.
Lake Annie, Florida, February 2008. A team of ecologists and technologists, faculty and students, deploy an environmental monitoring buoy over the deepest part of the pristine 90-acre lake. Powered by solar panels and rechargeable battery, the buoy carries half a dozen different sensors. Tim Meinke from the University of Wisconsin helped deploy the buoy.
At this point, we're looking at three sensor heads that actually deliver four pieces of information to us. This is an optical probe that will measure dissolved oxygen in the water.
Sensors also measure water temperature at different depths down to 65 feet, pH levels, and how clear the water is by comparing levels of sunlight above and below the surface of the lake.
This is a very old limnological parameter.
The buoy already had all the major hardware attached to it before we got to the lake. And so we were able to get it into the water off the edge of the dock. And then right away we had to put in the ballast, the heavy components that we couldn't put on at the lab but had to wait until the buoy was actually in the water to do. And so we put up a mast through the center of the flotation component of the buoy and then a big ballast weight on the bottom. Then we dragged everything out to the deep hole. Our buoy is tied over the deepest part of the lake to a mooring system that we had already prepared last weekend. Once we got the buoy to the mooring system, we had to tie it to the anchoring system and then attach various components.
The buoy is also equipped with a wireless transmitter to send the sensor data every 15 minutes to the Archbold Biological Field Station 2.5 kilometers away.
That distance is easily within the capabilities of the 900 megahertz radio system that we have installed on it. And what we have decided to do is take that signal and broadcast it from the lake to a radio tower located on our campus here that then relays the signal back into an office where a central computer is located for collecting that data and controlling the activities of the buoy.
We were able to know that it was actually transmitting because we called from the lake to the station to find that data was already streaming in. So that was miraculous to me and to see data already coming into the station.
The data were also streaming across the continent to the Cyber Infrastructure Laboratory for Environmental Observing Systems at the University of California, San Diego, where researchers Tony Fountain and Samir Tilak, among others, are designing software tools that lake researchers will need to handle a flood of sensor data from lakes in the future.
But the real excitement came when we finally turned the switch and saw the data flowing across the screen. And it was particularly rewarding for us as technology people.
There are large amounts of data that need to be moved from the sensor to someplace that's usable. And that's not a trivial task. And so developing the cyber infrastructure that allows for this data movement, organization, discovery, integration, and analysis is absolutely key.
So from this point, water moves in all directions, either superficially or from a groundwater flow in all compass directions.
Hilary Swain is the director of the Archbold Biological Field Station, the private ecological reserve that includes Lake Annie, the uppermost water in a chain of connected lakes and streams. Annie is one of the most studied lakes in Florida, with limnological surveys, taking measurements of physical, chemical, and biological conditions, carried out every month since 1983. Now Swain sees a new day dawning, thanks to the round-the-clock data streaming from the buoy.
What we had in the past is like we lived our life and we only had our eyes open for one day every month of the year. And you can imagine how much you would miss of a year if you only had your eyes open for one day of every month of the year. That was the amount of data we were collecting. And I see a completely different vision now. I see a vision that if we have these sensors deployed, what they really add to us is we are going to have our scientific eyes open here 24/7, 365, and that will revolutionize what we understand about the lake.
Our readings will be coming in every 15 minutes on the same kinds of information that we collect in our monthly program, but at a temporal frequency that will allow us to address a much broader set of questions, not only for our lake, but within this larger network that will be having data coming in at that same frequency.
Deployment of the buoy on Lake Annie coincided with a twice-yearly meeting of the Global Lake Ecological Observatory Network, GLEON for short, a grassroots group funded primarily by the National Science Foundation, building a scalable, persistent network of lake ecology observatories. The Archbold Field Station hosted the February meeting.
We had wanted to deploy a buoy for a very long time, and especially when we came into this network, we knew it was something on the horizon. But having the GLEON meeting here kind of prompted the actual deployment to happen at the same time, and it put a little fire under us to get all the equipment that we needed, all the people in place to really help and get it done.
Put the wiper on the dissolved oxygen.
We wouldn't be doing this if we didn't have, if we weren't part of the GLEON network and if we didn't have the help coming from that.
Florida's Lake Annie is the most recent member of GLEON to begin streaming its sensor data to the network's online data repository. Other U.S. members of GLEON include Kentucky Lake in Kentucky, the largest artificial lake east of the Mississippi. And in western New Hampshire, Lake Sunapee is the fifth largest lake located entirely in that state. An affiliated site to GLEON, Smith Mountain Lake, is located in Virginia's Blue Ridge Mountains. Five Wisconsin lakes are now online in GLEON, including Lake Mendota, as well as Trout Lake, and a collection of lakes nearby, including Crystal Bog Lake, Trout Bog Lake, and Sparkling Lake. And the northernmost member site in North America is Tulik Lake in Alaska, a major study site of the Arctic Long-Term Ecological Research Program funded by the NSF.
Many of the pressures that society has put on lakes are regional to global in nature, but yet they're manifested locally, one lake at a time. For example, we know that the climate is changing. We know that some areas of the world are going to become warmer, some are going to become colder, some are going to become wetter, some are going to become drier. This is a global influence, but yet the effects are manifest locally. How an individual lake is going to be affected by these global processes is something that we need to understand, but we also need to understand the global extent of the issue.
Cyber infrastructure is important for the GLEON network and the other environmental observing system initiatives because it is the medium by which you collect data, share data, and collaborate. Without these automated tools, it is not possible to do modern environmental science. The time when you could conduct your field research with a pen and pencil is long past.
What the cyber infrastructure allows you to do is cover a vast amount of space. And so really being able to integrate over space and time measurements that we haven't been able to do before. So it allows you now to ask different types of questions. So you can begin to think of lakes, if you will, as larger systems in the face of larger planetary systems. What role do they play when we start talking about the circulation of carbon in the atmosphere? What role do they play more broadly than just the single lake?
Those were some of the questions on the table when nearly 70 experts converged on the Florida Field Station for the GLEON meeting in early 2008. They came from China and Korea, Brazil and Argentina, Israel and Finland, 16 countries in all. Most were lake researchers and ecologists, others engineers or information technology experts, all looking for new ways to capture and share data and collaborate.
There is so much good science that's going on outside the borders of our country. We, just because of our own resource limitation, have to be able to tap into that. They have expertise that we don't have. We have expertise that they don't have.
The ability to tap into others' expertise in a network sense by having a network of scientists that are banded together is kind of new. And that's one of the strengths that GLEON brings, is the ability to share the expertise and experience from people that are geographically situated all around the world.
In barely 4 years, Gliese has mushroomed from just one member lake outside of the United States to more than 15 international member or affiliated sites today. Recent expansion to Brazil, including Lake Mangueira, brings South America into Gliese for the first time. Across the Pacific, several member sites are in Northeast Asia. They include the third largest freshwater lake in China, Lake Daihu, in Jiangsu Province, which is relatively new to the network. By contrast, the region also boasts the founding international site, Yuanyang Lake, in northeastern Taiwan, an area hit by an average of 3 to 7 typhoons annually, dumping up to 5,000 millimeters of precipitation on the lake every year. South Korea's Lake Soyang and Uyam Lake are also associated with Gliese. Other Pacific Rim member lakes in Gliese include New Zealand's Lake Rotorua, as well as affiliated sites in Australia, including Lake Torrens, a salt lake in South Australia, and a reservoir in New South Wales formed by Chaffee Dam, which regulates the flow of the Peel River. In the eastern Mediterranean region, Israel's Lake Kinneret, better known to many people as the Sea of Galilee, is fed by water and nutrients mainly from the Jordan River. Israeli researcher Ami Nishri has deployed sensors on the lake.
And we have a lot of benefits from this system. We know the power of it. And we are actually having the data transmitted to the lab. And we can actually, you come in the morning, you come to work, and you know what happened in the night, you know what happened in the lake. And if anything is worth studying more carefully, then you just use what was collected overnight.
One of the newest European lakes in Gliese is Ireland's Lake Fiaw, a freshwater lake near the country's Atlantic coast. Other member sites include the largest lake in Central Europe, Lake Balaton, in Hungary, a rift lake that is one of the region's top tourist destinations. Another popular site is the largest of the Berlin lakes, Germany's Müggelsee, which is 8 meters at its deepest. That is similar to the depth of Frederiksborg Slotso, a Gliese affiliate, also known as Castle Lake, because Frederiksborg Castle overlooks the lake north of Copenhagen in Denmark. Also in Scandinavia is one of Gliese's first international member sites, Sweden's Lake Erken, a clearwater lake where scientists from Uppsala University have been routinely measuring the lake's variables since 1988. And the next Gliese member expected to begin streaming data to the network, Lake Paajärvi in Finland, is set to go online in late 2008 or early 2009.
And so hopefully before the end of the year we will be in operation together with the Gliese database.
Gliese co-founder Tim Kratz directs Wisconsin's Trout Lake Station and chairs the Gliese Steering Committee.
We're no longer limited to only studying the lake in our backyard. We can, by having this set of colleagues in this network from around the world, we can ask questions that require us to look at data from many different climatic regimes or land use regimes or geographic extents, and we're able to do that. We have the mechanism to do that, and that is new.
Tim Kratz, Peter Arsberger, and Taiwan's Fengpeng Lin were present at the creation of Gliese. It stemmed from a partnership between the University of Wisconsin and Taiwan's National Center for High Performance Computing, which set up EcoGrid in 2002 as a way to give Taiwanese ecologists access to environmental sensors from their desktops.
Thanks to advanced networking technology and high performance computing, we are now able to link Taiwan's most important ecological reservations to a large database that can be easily accessed by researchers worldwide.
What EcoGrid did is there's many sensors already there, but they don't have network, so we connect them. So we try to build a kind of, we call it last miles, so which means we build up the local wireless or wild networks for them and bring the information back straight away. So you can sit in, well, basically it's a virtualized the field observatories as a kind of in-house lab.
Lin is on the steering committee of Pragma, the NSF-funded Pacific Rim Applications and Grid Middleware Assembly. The Pragma steering committee is chaired by UC San Diego's Peter Arsberger.
The reason that we were able to catalyze a relationship is that NSF had funded a project called PRAGMA, the Pacific Rim Application Grid Middleware Assembly, that really was initiated in 2002 that allowed us to make connections around the Pacific Rim with a lot of other institutions that were very interested in the application of high-performance computing, grid computing, or the development or use of cyber infrastructure.
The UC San Diego scientist was impressed with EcoGrid and introduced Lynn to one of the top U.S. experts on lake ecology, Wisconsin's Tim Kratz, who subsequently visited Yuanyang Lake, a small mountain lake in Taiwan.
We arranged to make a field trip to the lake. It turned out to be a really interesting lake from an ecological perspective. And to make a long story short, 6 months later, we had a set of instruments out on the lake streaming data onto the internet, and then we decided, well, if we were able to do this for two lakes halfway around the world from each other, what's to stop us from doing this on a global scale? And that's when the idea really struck us, that think of the power that we would have if we could bring together data from lakes, experts from lakes around the world to try to use this technology to understand some of the problems that lakes are facing today.
So now they can do a different kind of research, more analysis, more on the science. So that's what we help them. So they bring the information, also high frequency, real time. So that's all the key issues now we do in GLEON.
Lynn and Kratz have already co-authored multiple publications with fellow GLEON participants.
If you had asked me 5 or 8 years ago, would I ever co-author a scientific article with a colleague, a scientist in Taiwan, I would have said, I don't think so. And now it's becoming not routine, but not uncommon.
The simple fact of letting researchers compare data from the lakes in Taiwan and Wisconsin enabled important new insights.
We've been partnering with one of the original GLEON sites, the lake site in Taiwan. That is a lake that happens to be visited by typhoons several times a year. Yet chemically and physically, it's very similar to some of the lakes that we have in Wisconsin, which of course don't have those kinds of disturbances. So by comparing the lakes in Wisconsin with the lake in Taiwan, we're able to get a much better sense that the role of these large-scale disturbances play. And of course, one of the concerns that we have as climate is changing is that we're starting to see a higher incidence of these large-scale storm systems. So having a much better understanding of what these disturbances do is really valuable. And this kind of comparative study is one way to do that.
What was very interesting about the Taiwan Lake is something that most ecologists like to study, these very episodic events, these very large whether they're typhoons in Taiwan or, in fact, forest fires in Southern California, they disrupt the environment, the ecosystem. And what you have in Taiwan, of course, with the typhoons coming, is a very large disruptive event, which you don't have in the lakes in Wisconsin. You know, you have thunderstorms, but the typhoons really change dynamically what's going on in the lake. And we were able to see that real-time from sitting in our desks in California or Wisconsin.
The role of episodic events, such as typhoons in Taiwan, on lakes, is precisely what Ashley Shade is pursuing for her PhD at the University of Wisconsin.
I do work on microbial communities in lakes, and so I specifically study how they respond to disturbances, and my disturbance is lake mixing. And so in Taiwan, they have very unique lakes that overturn after being exposed to typhoons. So the typhoon will come through and mix the lake. And that's something we don't have in Wisconsin. And so GLEON has bolstered about a third or more of my thesis.
The graduate student was the recipient of an NSF East Asia Pacific Summer Institute Fellowship, which allowed her to conduct summer research in Taiwan. Shade says that without that fellowship and without GLEON, she would never have been exposed to the Taiwanese lake or been able to refine her ideas about microbial communities and disturbances.
Having instrumented buoys and having the IT support and the technology there allows me to access data about my lake in Taiwan from my desk in Wisconsin at any time of year. And so without that network and without those database and that infrastructure, I would not be able to conduct my analyses as I do right now.
A lot of the challenges that we face as a society in terms of the environment are really global in their nature, and so to develop the kind of collaborations where these scientists are able to share data and progress the science in the context of global things like climate change, I think is the importance, an important scale to be working at.
In order to work at that global scale, GLEON was founded as an international and interdisciplinary collaboration.
If you're looking at ecosystem research, it's very interdisciplinary, and not all of the expertise resides in one place. So what you have to do, and what ideally you do in the best research programs, is you pull in people who have specialist expertise that contribute to the big picture.
It's especially potent to take people who have an engineering and an information technology background and combine it with those of us who have more of an ecology background to try to advance the agenda.
The University of Wisconsin's Paul Hansen spearheaded a Research Coordination Network grant from the NSF to support GLEON activities, specifically to build the community of researchers.
GLEON is a grassroots network of people who are interested in advancing ecology using technology. And it's different from other approaches that might be highly structured and top-down. By having and developing a grassroots network, we empower the individuals who participate in GLEON to decide on the future of the network. The policies that we develop, the actions that we take, the science questions that we pose and we try to address.
So what NSF was able to do is allow us to begin the concept of building a community with a research coordination network that Paul Hansen's the PI on, that allows us to conceptualize this issue.
In addition to the NSF, major funding for GLEON in the U.S. comes from the Gordon and Betty Moore Foundation. UC San Diego's Peter Arsberger is the principal investigator on that private $2 million grant.
What the Moore Foundation allows us to do is to actually put in place a physical network that shares data for which the RCN, this other research coordination network, can draw upon.
Primarily, this includes the electronics where the sensors are wired in and a central logger that then can be programmed to control the information that's coming from the sensors.
A major impetus for the funding from NSF and the Moore Foundation is what lake science can teach other disciplines, specifically about how to use cyber infrastructure.
It doesn't matter so much whether you're studying oceans or forests or lakes or wetlands or something in between. From the cyber infrastructure perspective, many of the same challenges arise. And so by tackling the cyber infrastructure challenges holistically, we're able to develop solutions that will help scientists that are studying these individual systems, but we don't have to reinvent the wheel each time.
Non-U.S. members of GLEON get funding from their respective governments to participate or deploy sensors, and a growing number of international lake researchers appear convinced that understanding lakes will require deployment of sensors and automated monitoring equipment and comparing the data across types of lakes and even across geographies.
That's why we require an international network, so that we have examples of local systems that are in the northern hemisphere, the southern hemisphere, in the tropics, at the poles, in mid-latitudes, places that are in agricultural settings, in forested settings, in urban settings, lake systems that are deep, that are shallow, that are large, that are small, to get a complete understanding of how something as vast as climate change or land use change influences our aquatic resources requires that we have this diversity of systems that we're able to study it at locally.
According to Kratz, GLEON's most recent meeting attracted researchers from 16 different countries on five continents. Israeli researcher Ami Nishri has deployed sensors on the Sea of Galilee.
Perhaps the most important issue from my point of view is to be able to follow what happens to the system upon the introduction of floods or these major events that happen within a short time period. that when one cannot follow those by having a routine monitoring, like going out with a boat to ensample in the lake, this can only be done by deploying automatic instruments within the system. We know the power of it, and we are actually having the data transmitted to the lab, and we can actually, you come in the morning, you come to work, and you know what happened in the night.
In Finland, ecologists are working to integrate automated sensors on Lake Paajärvi into the Gleon network by the end of 2008.
Taking measurements with high frequency is very important because we know that there are many, many processes, physical, chemical, and biological processes, which take place within minutes or hours space. And so if we go once a month, or which is very good already in manual sampling, once a week, so we miss a huge amount of information, and we almost never get to the real time of measurements, and this is something I think we need very much.
A world away are New Zealand's Rotorua lakes.
For me, it was a very logical step to start to instrument these lakes.
David Hamilton holds an academic chair at the University of Waikato, funded by a regional environmental organization to pursue research on water resources.
If you didn't go out for 2 or 3 days and you missed an event of very, very low oxygen concentrations that essentially killed all of the aerobic organisms within the lake, then you might actually miss the whole change in the ecology of the system.
There isn't a replacement for people developing local understanding of how, for example, climate change influences the lakes in a particular region, or non-native species moving in and colonizing lakes in a particular region, or land use change occurring affecting lakes in a specific way in a particular region. These are global problems that are manifested locally. To accumulate and synthesize the results locally into a more global understanding, which is what's required for us to be able to face these problems globally and be able to make recommendations to policymakers about what our options might be, requires that we move beyond the "this is my study lake, these are my data" model to collectively, "these are our study lakes, these are our data, these are our understandings." And I think by and large, the scientific community is ready and even eager to move to that way of doing science.
There's a tremendous amount of interest recently in using aquatic systems as indicators of change in landscapes. In other words, how can lakes act as sensors of the landscape? And it's an idea that's very much in harmony with the idea of a sensor network. If we can understand the characteristics of lakes in terms of their response to the driving forces of the surrounding landscape, we have the opportunity to determine how anthropogenic or human effects alter ecosystems, and how broader effects such as climate change alter ecosystems.
Case in point, the impact of the dairy industry in New Zealand, where it's driving conversion of forests and pine plantations to pasture. With more cows and fertilizer on the land, there's more runoff of potentially contaminated water.
And that represents a very, very major challenge because on the one hand, it's an economic driver that's bringing prosperity to the country. On the other hand, it's something that is taking a lot of water away from our natural ecosystems and putting it back in a less than pristine state. So the country is at a little bit of a precipice.
Of course, there are very straightforward reasons why lake researchers are going to the trouble of deploying sensors and streaming their data over the internet.
Our field site in northern Wisconsin is 4 hours away from the university, and we would like to collect bacterial samples during times when it's raining or when the lake is mixing, and we can tell that by watching the buoy data, and my students can be going to classes and living their normal lives, and then when they see on the computer, on the streaming data, that this lake is about ready to mix or turn over, then they can jump in the car and be at the field site in 4 hours, which otherwise they'd have to live up there and go and check the lake every day manually.
Having the ability to monitor a lake day to day and even hour to hour is providing researchers with a new ability to combat similar problems, including the spread of cyanobacterial algae, even in lakes that used to be free of these so-called blooms, like the unexpected and unexplained blue-green alga bloom showing up in one of the first member sites in Gleon, New Hampshire's Lake Sunapee.
It was a surprise. There were no previous data, there was no previous information about this cyanobacterial bloom. So we began researching it just about the time that it showed up. There were no monitoring data available that would allow us to track this bloom over time. So
Kathleen Weathers, who spent childhood summers at Lake Sunapee, began studying the lake and its watershed with a local lake association while on a sabbatical. One of her internship students, Kaylin Carey, then an undergrad at Dartmouth College, got a Fulbright Fellowship to study the same phenomenon in Sweden's Lake Erken, another Gleon site, where algae blooms are long studied and common in high-nutrient lakes, unlike Lake Sunapee, which is a low-nutrient lake.
It was a really interesting experience because I was working with data and also the development of two Gleon sites simultaneously in the United States and in Sweden. We still have several hypotheses that have yet to be tested, but it's been really great to have the interaction between the Swedish scientists that have been working on these questions for decades, and the American scientists are just starting now to realize this is a problem in American lakes.
Carey also received an NSF pre-dissertation award to continue research as a graduate student at Cornell with Weathers as her co-advisor and in Lake Sunapee. Carey is now using Gleon data for her dissertation, focusing on plankton populations in these very disparate lakes that face invasive blooms. Her advisor in Sweden says Gleon is allowing scientists to tackle fundamental issues of the weather's impact on the environment.
In most of the lakes, there's no ice cover. No ice cover at all, or it's a much earlier ice cover at the moment. So we see changes in Sweden, in Norway, in Finland, and in Estonia, and all over Europe. So the question now is, does it matter? So in Gleon now, we hope that we can solve a bit the answer, does the earlier ice pickup, does it change with the ecosystem or not?
Blinkner recently received European funding to expand the number of sensors and automated buoys on Swedish lakes and to compare data across Scandinavian sites through Gleon.
There are fantastic people here. You can talk very in a nice way about complex systems. You can have brainstorming sessions where you can get up new ideas. You have exchanging knowledge about sensors or about data streaming. You can exchange PhD students, so it's just fantastic.
By expanding to a global network, we have access to a tremendous diversity of ecosystems that cover different ranges in hydrology and nutrient loading and food web dynamics and in weather and local climate driving.
For many countries, there are public policy reasons to step up monitoring of lakes.
Lakes provide a series of ecosystem services that people use directly. And these services might range from drinking water to recreation, transportation. Lakes sequester carbon in their sediments, and so they have a role to play in the global greenhouse gas issue. There are a whole series of ways in which lakes are important to society.
Of all the water we have, about 1% of it is drinkable at all. So clearly, if we look forward, and especially now that in Southern California, where we happen to be, where predictions are of drought over the coming years, care of water resources and the health of those water resources is very, very important. Lakes play a very important role.
Take China's Lake Daihu, an important source of drinking water in bustling cities nearby.
Along this lake, there are lots of big cities such as Shanghai, you know, and Shuzhou, Wuxin. All these cities are very big. And also, it's because it is an industrialized area in China, so it's a very important area.
Industrial or agricultural pollutants can lead to the cloudiness or turbidity of the water, and lakes in many countries suffer from an increase in chemical nutrients, so-called eutrophication, with excessive plant growth leading to a decrease in water quality. In South Korea, Lake Soyang supplies half the water to the capital city of Seoul's 15 million inhabitants.
Recently, we have some trouble with eutrophication of reservoirs and some turbidity problems due to soil erosion from agricultural field.
We felt it was particularly important to bring scientists together from around the world to try to better synchronize the observations that we can get from new sensing systems, like the buoys that we deploy on lakes, and the models that we use to interpret those data and the inference that we gather from those data.
Those computer models simulating ecological processes require solid data, and that's another reason driving scientists to join GLEON.
Modeling is one of the centerpieces of our work. It's a good tool to foresee the future and also allows you to drive new questions, because you don't need to test anything in the field. You just need to ask your model, changing the boundary conditions, what's going to happen. So your question can be really be answered really fast, and that drives you to a new thinking and new ideas, and perhaps gives you new insights or things about things.
We're at the stage now that there is enough critical mass in a couple of areas, one of modeling, another of microbial ecology, another of really understanding that role of episodic events that came up several times, as in the lake in Taiwan, that we really want to understand the role of episodic events on lakes. Sharing the data becomes now a vehicle by which more collaboration can take place. We're all very busy collecting data. If there's someone else that can analyze it and attribute it correctly, we'll learn more. I mean, what would be worse than collecting a bunch of data and it never having been used?
By making most of their data available to the public as well, GLEON members hope to engage more community organizations and citizen scientists in environmental research and lake management.
The original drive for funding my position actually came from the citizens of Rotorua. There's a community-based organization called the Lakes Water Quality Society, and they were really quite upset with the changes that were occurring in the Rotorua lakes. In other words, that they'd seen some degradation of water quality in those lakes. And so they started putting pressure on the government at a variety of levels, local government, regional government, and even the federal government, to start to do something about this. And one of the outcomes for that was that they agreed, the regional government agreed to fund a full-time position and support students to do research on the Rotorua lakes.
Nowhere is the citizen science credo more apparent than in New Hampshire, where members of the Lake Sunapee Protective Association were among the very first to discover those cyanobacterial algae blooms in the Clearwater Lake. Kathleen Weather suggested that an automated buoy might allow the community to monitor the invasive blooms more effectively.
I brought the idea back to them, and they were immediately intrigued. Even people who have no interest in science were immediately intrigued. Can we see the temperature in the lake by logging on to the web? And so they became intrigued. They actually financed the buoy. They gathered together volunteer engineers to create a design for the buoy, and they're full participants as well. And so this partnership is quite remarkable that centers on the buoy and the data coming from the buoy.
Through GLEON involvement, Weathers, principal investigator of the recent NSF-CI or Cyber Infrastructure Team Award, will lead a team of GLEON computer and information scientists to build stronger ties to the Lake Sunapee Protective Association and to build with citizen scientists new cyber infrastructure tools. Weathers believes that partnership with GLEON and the co-development of tools will enable Lake Sunapee's citizen scientists to share their model with other communities around the world.
There was tremendous potential for buoy and data to be a common language, not only for scientists, but for lay scientists, for people who are interested in their lakes, their water resources, and they're also interested in streaming data. And I don't actually know why they're interested in streaming data, but people are interested in seeing data on the web, and it seemed like a terrific opportunity to have data available to people who are interested and begin to interpret those data.
Gleon is also hoping to use the network to leverage educational outreach programs, especially those targeted at K through 12 students.
We're very interested in getting children to be involved with science. We realize that's our future, and for me as a university teacher, I need to have children coming through who want to learn about science. And so what we're doing is trying to put some of our buoy data out there for children, to get children involved in the practical element of going out onto a lake and seeing what we do and participating in what we do, bring them back, seeing what organisms they can find in the laboratory. And the next step is to actually get them to see and plot up some of the data that are being collected in an automated fashion through the buoy.
Gleon is using tools, new tools, that allow us to answer questions that we couldn't answer before at timescales that we couldn't understand in the past without these sensors. And with a network like Gleon, we can ask them across space in a way that we couldn't ask before. It's a global network.
It's hard, believe it or not, to find good replicates of lakes because you're stuck with whatever you have in your location that you're at. And Wisconsin has a lot of beautiful lakes, but sometimes we need a lake that's different enough in some kind of way that we can't find in Wisconsin, or maybe we prefer that it be at a different latitude or a different elevation. And so if we go to one of these sites somewhere else on the globe, then we can get a similar lake, but that has one of these factors different. So we can do really more controlled comparisons that way.
When it comes to building a cyber infrastructure community, though, Gleon co-founder Tim Kratz thinks there is no substitute for meeting face-to-face.
One of the things that we do is try to have meetings about every 6 months to foster the social network that really is the key to this international collaboration. It gets people together face-to-face. We not only discuss the science and technical issues, but we also socialize with each other. We become comfortable with each other. We get to know each other. And that is the key to be able to do cutting-edge collaborative science across an international network.
The director of Argentina's Institute of Oceanography agrees and believes the Gleon meetings are critical building blocks for the lake research community.
If I see it from a scientific point of view, I like the science we are going, you know, to see, to experience, to interchange. But if I see it from my personal view also, I like the people. I mean, I feel very much comfortable here. I like it, the participation of our graduate students.
At the Gleon meeting in Florida, there was a push to get more graduate students involved and from different backgrounds. Kaylin Carey is the graduate student lead for the Gleon Research Coordination Network.
For the first time, we have a substantial number of IT graduate students and aquatic ecology graduate students, which regularly don't normally interface in their home universities. But by coming together, we're trying to develop a vocabulary by which we can interact and share data and kind of explain this is what the data is, where they're coming from and how we're using them, and this is what we need, our data needs as scientists, and also how IT people can explain, well, this is what our technology is doing at the same time.
Graduate students held their own sessions in Florida to identify topics of special interest to students.
We're basically, there's several needs that we've identified for students, everything from managing large data sets to statistics to buoy science, and that there'll be these weekends, which we envision, where students and experts come together to learn about these subjects.
Sensor networks are very definitely the wave of the future, and this gives these students the opportunity to have first-hand contact with that type of, not just the data itself, but the mechanics of how that works.
Students are really fun because, for one, they tend to be savvy in terms of cyber infrastructure and high tech. And so they grew up with this, they understand it, they know how to use it, and they have great ideas for how it can be used to advance our science. The experience that Glianna is able to give students, I think, will be invaluable as they start their careers, but the students also give back to Glianna because they bring such such creativity, energy, and technological savvy.
Just think of this. As we go on over the next 20 years, which is going to be very critical for our environment, having students be able to understand and see data from these types of lakes, I think will be very transformational. They will become part of the longer-term process of maintaining the environment, if not only maintaining it, improving the environment. And this is where education is so important now.
These larger-scale networking kinds of science are going to be a significant way in which science is done in the future. And I think Gleon is trying to be very creative and aware about training students to be able to step into leadership roles in the future in terms of these larger networks.
Working groups within Glion are also trying to answer questions that could not even be posed without the comparison data now being generated at member lakes. For example, what are the controlling forces on dynamics of lakes at vastly differing timescales?
Dissolved oxygen changes over timescales of minutes, hours, days, seasons, and years. And we would very much like to understand what controls those changes at each of those timescales. Well, we could do that in a lake that's at 45 degrees north latitude that has a certain climatic regime, and we could get some understanding. But if we compare that to a lake that's on the equator or a lake that's up in the mountains or a lake that's in one of the polar regions, we would get a much richer understanding, and we've been starting to do that. For example, we've now seen that there's been an unexpected increase in oxygen that occurs during the nighttime in lakes all around the world. And that's very curious to us, and it's something that we would not have discovered without having these data available from this broad extent of lakes.
Back at Lake Annie, the deployment of the instrumented buoy was a success, and the field station's director says the goal is now to deploy other sensors in other areas of the ecological reserve.
The greatest value of sensors is that they give you ability to collect continuous data. No biologist could be in the field 24/7. And suddenly now it's like you've got a technological ally out in the field with you. It's like you've got a research technician all the time there collecting good, consistent data for you. So that's completely changed the way you think about biology.
And I think the international participation between all the different countries is the way of science goes. Science has to be, you know, we have to share our different experience, our different knowledge. If we have to learn because we don't know, well, we learn. And this is science. I mean, we're working together.
So far, what we've been able to do is to create a network of scientists around the world that have been putting sensors in their own local lakes for their own local purposes. With Glion, we've been able to share our experiences and expertise. And so that the sophistication with which we're putting out these sensors has increased because we've learned from each other's experiences. We're right at the edge now where these data are becoming available for everyone to look at from all of these lakes. I think Glion is at the cusp of really doing some significant things.
As more buoys are deployed on more lakes around the world and more data is shared within the Glion network, the cyber infrastructure will give researchers the chance to collaborate in new ways. But eventually, the value of these new high-tech tools will depend on the answer to one simple question.
Of, are we going to be able to do new science? And ultimately, that's the bottom line. That's the metric by which we will declare ourselves successful and actually prove or not this notion that cyber infrastructure is really about community building and new science. Ultimately, what will sell Glion in the long run is the ability to do science.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.